Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
To the sweet sounds of Kevin Bloody Wilson off my iPhone, it is Hump Day with Swanee and friends, Dane Swan, and guest friend with Samantha, selfishly being on maternal duties, Joe Watson. Hello, mate. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You two got a little bit in common over the journey.
What?
You're different type of personalities, but you got a bit
Brownlow medalist. I remember playing against Swanee in 2005. I was playing for Essendon VFL. Swanee was playing for Williamstown out at Williamstown Oval. And
what a beautiful oval that is!
Yeah, beautiful windswept. Oh, but we probably our careers weren't probably going in the direction either of us had hoped. And thankfully, we were able to rectify it and turn it around.
The old days.
Yeah,
yeah.
Reboot it. So you're Williamstown reserves. For people who haven't heard this, what you said, how many people were watching you in Williamstown reserves?
Well, if you believe what most supporters tell me now, about 80,000. It was amazing. Like, I remember you, like, this one old mate, I knew you were going to make it from day one. I was watching you down in the Williamstown, thought, yep, you're going to be a player. I said, yeah. Bullshit. I didn't even think I was going to be any good. None of my parents didn't think I was going to be any good, let alone the four supporters who were watching the reserves down at Point Jellybrand at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning. But we all got to start somewhere, don't we?
I remember a greyhound came onto the ground one time I was playing there, and the guy I was standing next to, I said, why doesn't someone try and catch it? He goes, it's a fucking greyhound. No one's going to catch it on the ground.
The best thing about Willie was Harold from Neighbours was a big fan.
Oh,
was
really?
A supporter, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He used to sit in the crowd and watch. That was my first introduction to stardom. Yeah, running past, walking back into the race and seeing Harold just standing outside. It's fucking Harold from Neighbours. I've made it. You know, when Harold was coming to watch me, but actually those were the days. It should be our 20-year reunion coming up.
Of
our premiership, by 2003, yeah. Yeah. So I won one down there.
Is that, well, surely that won't be another function you miss out, given.
Well, we've missed out on our 10-year AFL reunion.
Yeah.
Yeah. God knows when that's going to happen with what's going on in the world, but I'm sure Collingwood will do one because footy clubs like making an earn off premierships. So at some stage, I'd imagine we'll have a function at the. Like at the Crown or somewhere, because 1990 missed out too, so they had their, 20-year reunion. We had it meant to have our 10. But obviously the world being how it is, we haven't been allowed, which sucks. But yeah.
What was your equivalent of Williamstown reserves when you thought, probably not where I'd...
Where I need to be?
Yeah. What do they call it? Career trajectory?
Yeah, we were affiliated with Bendigo for a period of time.
It's a tough drive.
We were doing the Sunday morning, we're in a mini bus going up the highway to Bendigo, and I thought, hang on a minute, this isn't what I thought AFL football was like. I'm going to do something about it. I remember kicking the dew off up at the Queen's Elizabeth Oval up there and thinking, God, I'm a long way from anywhere. But sometimes it's character building, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
You need to be at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't get it easy. No. But I didn't mind it in my first couple of years because I don't know how Essendon had to do it, but we didn't have to train with the seniors or anything. We just had to train it. We had to come in and do weights, which I took that as being optional. Because they'd obviously have their train during the day. They'd be like, all right, just come in, do your weights, and go to Willy. So we have to be at Willy like 5 o'clock or something like. So mate, you'd sit home all day, pop your head in at the footy club, like do the Homer, you know, the Abe Simpson app, walk in, put your hat out, then just walk straight back out. Then race over to bloody Willy, and I guess how the probably sums up where I was. We'd go over to the chicken shop, eat chips and gravy, and like a chicken roll or something before training. Go out, you know, have a kick in the freezing cold conditions. And then play for Willie the next day or 2 days later. And then I'd hardly seen the senior blokes because then we'd have our own rehab. Like we'd be on our own schedule because the ones obviously played in different spots and they'd have their own schedule. And Mick only wanted the senior group to train with each other and didn't give a shit about us. kick me off the track more than once.
What was your equivalent?
Yeah, we used to go to the social club at Windy Hill and have chicken schnitzel sandwiches pre-training. And there'd be guys making a request for no salad on the side. Just chips, gravy, and chicken schnitzel sandwiches.
So good, so good.
You wonder why you're not feeling great when you're running around at 3 o'clock training.
Yeah, skinnies weren't a... Always had quite the issue with skinnies, but went real high on my list of priorities of getting down with skinnies at that age.
And were you straight into the senior team, or was it, or did you have your apprenticeship as well?
Nah, I was. I played one game in my first year in the AFL, and then maybe five or six second year. And by the third year, I was sort of going nowhere. Like that was sort of where we like the 3 years in the system, and you're running around in the twos, and you're thinking, "Oh God, this is not going well." But I was probably back then a bit more fortunate. There's a bit more leeway with the contracts and stuff like that. Like, I had 4 years really, like before you sort of got an opportunity to either get flicked or not. So they gave me. Nowadays, I don't reckon you'd get that sort of luxury where you did back then,
unless you're a ruckman.
Yeah, unless you're developing tall. Yeah, exactly. Like that.
Yeah, get eight years to prove you. You can play and you can't play and everyone else gets 2 years to prove you can.
Yeah.
I was exactly the same.
So fast forward to now, as in post-career, just while we're in the pandemic and everything else. So we and this is part of the reason we're doing this, obviously, sending out everyone who's in a shitty lockdown at the moment, but particularly those hit in hospitality and in fitness. Tell us a couple of areas you've been working in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do feel for everyone, specifically in those industries. And I've got some businesses in New York who are one in hospitality and the other one in fitness as well. So chosen two good industries to be in when a pandemic arrives. And they've been, I mean, the American, how they've done, they had a different approach. I mean, they were heavily locked down, in the early part of 2020. But then their vaccine rollout's been, really, really far more progressive than what we have here. And so they're now at the stage. I mean, New York just mandated that you can't enter a restaurant or a theater or a gym without showing proof that you've been vaccinated. And that's the expectations of people living in New York is that people are vaccinated. I mean, it's a very sort of left place and progressive sort of democratic area in the States. But that is where they're at. They've sort of seen it as we can't return to a COVID normal or a normal life without mass vaccinations. And that's been the philosophy of them. And the Americans, they don't sort of wait for things to, they get out in front of stuff and they do it and they...
Very similar to here.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not a lot of choice when industries and things like that want to do things, they get it done and that's been the approach. But there's been times where we've had to let a lot of staff go and shut the doors completely.
Yep.
Thankfully though, there's been a lot of government support as well over there.
When's the last time you were there?
I wasn't there. I haven't been there since 2018.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And I doubt I'll be there until probably 2023, I reckon.
So in your head, prior to pandemics and all that, what were you going to be a two-country sort of person? Or?
Yeah, I would like to. And then my sort of partner wanted to get on the kids train and we sort of decided to settle predominantly here in Melbourne.
She American?
She's Dutch. So, but she'd lived in New York for 6 years, and New York was sort of home for her. And then she made the decision to come out here and move her life out to Melbourne. And I was sort of keen to go back to New York. Yeah. And she was like, well, I've picked everything up and come out here for you. So let's sort of stay here for a while.
You're stuck now anyway.
And there's no reason to go anywhere. So Melbourne is home. And then probably I'd always like to have that connection to New York. And then obviously Europe is home for her.
What is home for you? You got two kids?
Yeah, yeah, two kids. So we've got Juniper who turns 3 in September, and then Wolf turns 1 in October. So I was saying to Swanee, you know, recent father, that everyone kept telling me that there was a bigger jump between 1 and 2 than there was from 0 to 1. And I was like, there's no possible way it could be any harder going from no kids to 1 kid.
Yeah.
And then I've had 2 and I've realised, yep.
I don't know how people do it. Shit.
Are you from family, 2 kids?
Is it, pardon?
You're from 2 kids? Yeah. You're from 4.
I'm from 4, yeah. Yeah. And you do get a greater appreciation for particularly what your mother did for you.
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Fuck 2. I'm not sure I'm ready for that yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unlike Tim and Susie, you've become a dad at an older age too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess it was the generation before us. Mum and Dad had us when they were 23. And I wanted to experience life a bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But you were gone as a 23-year-old.
Well, thank God we did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
exactly
now,
right.
Thank God I don't know about you, but I chose to. Well, my foot kind of made a decision for me, but thank God I got to retire and then, a bit like Joe, travel the world and have 3 or 4 years where I could pick up and leave. Because I'd hate to be retiring nowadays, because what you do is when you finish footy, you go, all right, I'm going to have a year and go see the world, and you're stuck here now. So I'm quite thankful that I got to do some amazing things after footy. Now, obviously, the family life's stuck and I can't do anything anyway, so I was like, well, fuck it, I might as well have a family. So, but yeah, it's wild. So I had mine at 37, so
yeah.
36 to 10 days before my birthday. But it's just the generation. I think generations are getting older for families now anyway. Like you said, our parents had us in our 20s, and 35, 36 is just normal for people having families these days.
Yeah, there was always that analogy that if you're sitting there eating your cornflakes, you want to be thinking back to the times where you had some good memories. So yeah, the longer you're left, you're going to be sitting there at the breakfast table with noise around you for a long time.
Exactly, because people always say, man, I can't remember what I did before I had children.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I can. Yeah. I had a great time. That's literally all I think about. Sitting there eating cornflakes is what I did before children. It's all I think about. So I know exactly what I used to do. I can't do it anymore, unfortunately.
No.
But post-career, this is where you're very, very different, the two of you. I've found something very, very different. You're in New York, and A, you sought out some work, and B, it was unpaid.
That's an oxymoron, isn't it?
So what was it?
Well, my reason for it was when I was there, because I went in 2016 when we were banned, and I thought, look,
why'd you choose to go to New York?
I'd always wanted to live in New York, and I had 2 friends who were living there, and I thought it's as good a place as any to go.
Yeah.
And so I loved American culture, and I loved New York every time I'd been there, but I'd always had a desire to like live and immerse myself in a city.
Yeah.
Every time I travelled at the end of the season, I'd love it, but it was gone, you know, like, and you never really get a feel for a city until you'd live there. So New York was the place I wanted to go. And when I arrived there, after, you know, a couple of weeks, I realised that I needed some structure in a week. Otherwise, things could get, as you know, New York, there's a lot of temptations in New York and you get yourself into trouble. And I thought, I need to have some structure, and I wanted to learn a new skill. And I thought just something really simple like this would be really fun, and it would be something really different where I could talk to people and engage with Americans and things like that, and have just a bit of a very opposite existence to what I'd had in the AFL industry and footy, and it would give me some structure each week. And that was the reason behind it. And I reached out to...
Is it a hard skill becoming a barista?
It took me a while. Like, I stuffed up a lot of people's coffees. And, like, fortunately, you know...
So, did you know a bloke at a cafe, or did you just run into a random one one day and go, can I learn?
So, the girl that I... my friend who was there, she introduced me to the guy.
Yeah.
And Barry had this tiny little place inside a building. It was like an old news agency, and that's where it was, and that's where it started. That's where Hole in the Wall started. And I'd go up there twice a week and do a shift for a day.
Yeah.
And I absolutely loved. Like, we had a ball. You know, yeah. It was a real simple existence for me, but it was that simplicity of it and. is what I really liked, you know, just engaging with people and just having doing a job that you would have done typically if you were 19, 20 working in a bar, which I'd never had that experience and actually really enjoyed it.
But they've got good forward defences, Americans. Did you ever think, fuck, a year ago I was out at the MCG, now I'm copping a gobful for fucking up a coffee?
Well, I liked that no one knew who I was or what I was doing there, and no one knew the reason why I was in New York either. So I really enjoyed sort of just chatting to everyday people and finding out, you know, because I love American culture. So it was about, you know, talking to people about where they're from, what they're doing in New York. And then it's a very... It's quite an intimate 5-minute conversation, and then it's gone, you know, and then you're on to the next one. But if you're working and you repeat the process with these people, you start to learn a little bit about their lives, and that's what I enjoyed.
Did you have any Aussies like just walk in and go, oh, can I have a coffee? And like give you the double look like, Joe Boston?
I had a couple of people do it, but they were fine, and I just sort of chatted to them about why I was there, and they were, you know, again, they were over there working or doing their own thing, and New York's one of those places where you get this melting pot of like people from all over the world come there, and they all want to make it there. They've all got some story about why they're there, what they're trying to do, and it's a great networking city too. You know, like people will go, oh, I know this person, I can help you get that in. That's American culture, and that's why I think it's such a desirable place to go.
So part of it was Hutchie one of the hookups to say, Who should I speak to? Or
yeah, well, I used to go to and catch up with Hutchie every time I'd go to New York. He'd be sitting there at his bar on the West Village there, and
keeping it up.
Yeah, making sure that it was still stocked. And I'd always catch up with him when I was there. We had Christmas lunch there one day year when I was there with the family. So I had a lot of sort of like connections from New York, and Hutch was a good one.
And the fitness one, so was that, you took that over to the States?
So the F45 was what I'd done here, and I remember going, you know, that Port Melbourne one that it opened up, and I just sort of thought, oh, this is a really good opportunity to have something like this, because I was doing a lot of training when I was in New York, but there wasn't any sort of high-intensity sessions like that, and so we thought, oh, look, let's... I lived in Williamsburg, and I thought it was a really similar sort of profile to Melbourne and some of the areas that I thought, you know, F45 had done well in. So that was the reason for bringing it over there.
And has it kicked?
It has. I mean, the pandemic has been...
That aside?
Yeah, it's been difficult for it, but it has... It's gone well in that sort of area and suburb, but there's a lot more competition in that space now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Off the beaten track, are you more an off the beaten track type of traveller apart from New York?
Yeah, I used to go with a group of guys, sort of 4 or 5 guys every year, and we would go all over the world really, and I loved to do different experiences. I loved to go to different cities, and that was always, you know, like when I look back, that's my fondest memories of that period is the travel trips that I was able to go through.
Give us some Brownlow style, 3, 2, 1. What were the best places?
I loved Berlin. We stayed in Berlin for a couple of weeks, and I loved Berlin. I thought it was a cracking city.
In the summer or the winter?
No, well, we were October, sort of September, October. So it was getting cold, but it had a great, you know, like, you know, when you get a feel for a place and you're there and you're like, God, this has got a real sort of substance to it, and edgy and a lot of history as well. So I really liked that. Where else was a good trip? Budapest, I thought was a good place. Like some of these European little cities on the.
Swanee's waiting for you to say Vegas.
Well, Vegas was a staple. But you sort of, I mean, Vegas is Vegas, you know.
Exactly.
Like
I hate that place as much as I love it.
Yeah. So, but anyone that's been there, you're not telling them anything new about what. Everyone who goes there knows exactly what they're there for.
Exactly.
Austin, Texas is a great city too. Well, it's got like, you've got the Longhorns there, so it's a big college town. But then you've got the South. There's a lot of the feeling of the South there too. Great food, and it always had a lot of fun on 6th Street.
Anywhere where you're on holidays is fun.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
it's going through your mind a bit at the moment, isn't it?
Oh, man, I can't remember. My missus is obviously from New York, so she's hanging to get back. But
yeah.
God knows when that's going to be. So it just makes me upset thinking about when my next holiday is going to be, because I can't even go to Queensland,
yeah,
Ralph. So don't worry about going to the other side of the world.
I did a hiking trip in Norway.
Yep.
And that was a lot of – like, that was off the beaten track a little bit, and a guy told me about
– as a holiday?
As a holiday
on
the year off.
With mates.
No, but I met a mate there, yeah. And this was in the year off, so I was sort of looking for stuff to do, and I met a guy, and he said to me, "Look, I did this hike in Norway, and these are the places that I stopped, and this is what, and that's what I did." That was like something that you don't do every day, that was a lot of fun. Beautiful place, Norway.
Tell us the Iceland route, because I like this one. What is it? It's free accommodation if you go to Iceland.
Yeah.
But it's the most expensive.
It's the most expensive place in the world, yeah.
So
yeah.
Nothing for nothing.
It's free accommodation for anyone.
Well, they allow you to have a free stopover if you fly Icelandic Air.
Okay.
So we were flying from New York to Holland, and they said, look, you could stop for free in Iceland, and you get a reduction on your accommodation if you do that. And then you're there, and a piece of toast costs you $22.
Was it? Oh, how was the toast? Was that Vegemite?
They had jam on toast. But it's like they've sort of called it this Frankenstein rule, where it's the monster you create, because they obviously collapsed after the financial crisis. Iceland was one of the worst places hit. And so tourism has been the thing that has just kept the economy going. But everything's become so expensive. So now the locals struggle to live in the place now as well. But it's a beautiful place to go.
Do you recommend it going?
I do, but I wouldn't take kids there.
Are you still an OTV type of guy at home?
Kids? No, I don't have TV. Yeah, we don't have one. Yeah.
A what?
You don't have what?
Don't have a TV.
At home?
Don't have a TV, though. I've got a broken TV that sits on a shelf.
Trying to wrap my head around that. What do you do all week?
We've got, like, devices and things like that they use, but...
haven't been watching the Olympics or anything?
No, I haven't seen any of the Olympics. I watch it, like, I've got a game NFL game pass, which is all I really want. And the NBA game pass
There's
as well.
There's a game today, actually, no? Dallas are playing.
Yeah, I think they're playing maybe the Hall of Fame game or whatever they do. Yeah. Dallas. Hard Knocks starts next week as well. So.
Dallas. Cowboy Steelers today.
Yeah.
Fuck, that's why you don't have a TV. You don't watch yourself back on your when you're doing the Channel 7 stuff? You
know? Nah, I'd hate to. I don't do that.
So how do you watch?
Mum gives me all the feedback that I need.
How do you watch all the footy to keep up with your...
I've got a KO subscription, so I can watch it on a
computer.
On my computer, yeah.
And I feel like I suck saying this, but I've known you for a while, a little bit, but you I'm loving the special comments you're doing and the way you're doing it. Have you modelled yourself like a Tony Romo or other type of sports that you can say, well, I can do it a certain way?
Well, I listened to a podcast recently with Troy Aikman. He was a special guest with Sean McVay, and he just talked about how he goes through it, and I just try and have a philosophy of, just trying to explain the why of how I see it. I don't like to be critical of people. I think that, anyone can tell you what someone should have done or what they didn't do well. It's just trying to explain and highlight how great, the game is and how great the athletes are that perform it, and never forget how difficult it was. So I like to do the commentary. I don't like to be someone who commentates the game sort of more than just what they're seeing on the ground.
So I'm channeling our mate Scotty Cummings from our first year. Yeah. He had a good saying, I'd rather hole punch my ball bag. Is that what you would rather do than be on one of those paddle shows just bagging the shit out of players on a weekly basis?
Yeah, I think...
It doesn't seem like it's you.
No, it's not me. And I think that's the thing. Like, you've got to be sort of true to what you... Like, if it makes you feel uncomfortable, then it's not worth doing it. So I enjoy the commentary and only really commentating about the games.
Are you in the studio or are you at the games?
Just depends. All the international, all the interstate were in a studio.
Surely that's tough because have you got behind the ground vision and stuff?
Not really, no, no.
So you can only see what we can see on the telly?
Yeah, yeah.
So that'd be tough, wouldn't it? Because you wouldn't be able to...
You can't clearly sort of forecast what's happening. Yeah. And when you're at the ground, you can say, okay, well, this is what's happening.
This is why it's happening.
This is why it's happening. But then you've also got to... It's taken a lot to sort of learn because you've got to remember there's no point talking about what the audience can't see.
Yeah,
because then it becomes sort of irrelevant for people. You've always got to remember that what the audience is seeing is what you should be, you know, talking about and then just trying to...
Has that been an instruction?
Well, not. I mean, it is. It's part of what I think makes it relevant is you sort of go, okay, well, what are people going to connect with? Because you're trying to just connect them to what they're watching, you know. And you want to make them, you want to educate them, but you don't want to force stuff down their throat.
No, I know it's a fine line because it's probably the only sport in the world where what's happening off camera is very relevant.
Yes, yeah, and that's the thing. But you can't. A lot of people just want to watch the game and enjoy it.
Yeah,
and but then there's the other side of it who want to know more about the tactical, and so you've got a very broad audience that you're trying to cater to. But I think that if you can try and explain the why of what is happening, that's what I try and endeavour to do.
And what's been a surprise about doing that job? And
it's much harder than what I thought it would be.
Right.
Yeah, it's much harder to to be concise, to explain what's going on in the TV, to come up with new things all the time, to not repeat yourself. Like it's a real there's a lot of research and stuff like that you need to do.
After all the shit that happened with Essendon, did you think you'd be back in footy?
Not really, no. Yeah. No, I thought that I'd probably move away from it. And I like that I have a little bit of it, but it's not my life.
Do you love the game like you did, or is sort of the passion gone after everything that happened?
I probably don't love it like a 16-year-old kid who dreamed about playing footy. I've learned to sort of move on from what happened, but it doesn't have the same feeling to me that it once did. Yeah.
And would that also be that now you're older and your parents and, you know, you've got other perspectives in life too?
Yeah, I think the relevance of it, you know, when you're living in it, it's funny, you know, like it becomes all you really know and your whole world is surrounded by that. And then when you leave, you're like, God, there's a lot of things that I was sort of probably too focused on and I should have had a bit more perspective. But if you're going to be good at something like that, it sort of demands that attention from you.
Yeah.
And I guess as you get older, you get a little bit more of perspective of the rest of stuff on life.
Do you follow Essendon?
I still follow Essendon, and it's more like for love of the guys that are still there and then the supporters. I think you appreciate the supporters a lot more after you leave, I find. Like and especially...
How have they been with you?
Yeah, I've always had a great relationship with them, and I found them to be... and supporters of all clubs, really, have always been really well treated by all supporters. But the Essendon people, I think you get appreciation because you realise how busy life gets, you know, when you've got work and you've got a family and all that sort of thing. And then you see the passion that these people have for the footy club. And you're like, God, you guys commit so much. For me, you know, it was work and I was getting paid and it was a job and I loved it. Hmm. But for you, you know, like you devote so much time, money and energy into this club out of love. And I think that is really commendable.
Have you been back?
I've sort of been there to visit a little bit, but nothing really. Yeah. They had an event at the start of this year, which I went to, but that's about it.
Because that's one of the things as a suburban footballer, in quotation marks, but in reality, any old player was always loved and welcome and beauty. This is part of it, but it's not a workplace.
Yeah.
So, and I've spoken to many mates who I worked with or became mates with who were elite footballers or cricketers, and they just know that they don't feel comfortable being back in the workplace environment under most circumstances, unlike a local footy club that most people listening to this would relate to.
Yeah, I think there is a difference because of that. And things, the professionalism of the clubs move on so quickly, and the players change and turn over and staff turns over so quickly. So you can go back 5 years later and you go, oh, I don't really know many people here anymore, and I feel like a little bit of an outsider. And
is that what you felt like when you took the cab around earlier this year at Collingwood?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's obviously the same, like the booth starter and like you know, the property steward and all, they're all the same, but the admin staff is completely different, and obviously the players, which is the big one. I don't even know half the people's names in there.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
6 years ago, you walk in, you're like the Pied Piper, you know, like, everyone loves you. And at this stage, like, I'm not sure they know who I am.
Yes,
and like, I don't know who they are. So it was a little odd, but yeah, exactly the same as Joe. And I tried to purposely create a distance between myself and the footy club because I was such a big part of it for 15 years. Like, and when I was playing, like, you'd see all the old boys come in and, like, sit and have lunch. I mean, it was fine for on the odd occasion, but when they were in there every week, you're like, mate, fucking go do something else. Yeah. Like, your time's come and gone. So I didn't want to be one of those old blokes who hung around the club every day and trying to still think I was a part of the side because, you know, I obviously wasn't, and they needed to move on without me. So that's, I've tried to purposely keep a distance, and they wouldn't have wanted me back anyway, I'm sure, but especially when Nathan was there. But new coach might be different. But, I purposely tried to create a little bit of a vacuum away from the footy club.
So on my list of things that you might have in common, neither of you seem like you want to coach at AFL level, just as a guess.
No, I don't have that desire. I think the only thing I would say, like, I loved the game growing up, and, you know, like, I always thought I would, you know, do it, you know, wanted to play, and you have so much knowledge about it that it seems like it's a bit of a waste to just, like, put it in the box and leave it.
Yeah.
So the only thing I would think about, if, you know, coaching or getting back involved in, is if I would sort of did a full circle and went and did other things in life, you know, had a family, the family got older, and then I went back to footy out as a real desire, you know, like if I was 55 or 60.
Yeah.
But for me, it was like part of my life that I needed to say goodbye to and move on. And the progressive, you know, progression in life meant that I couldn't stay in that industry anymore. I needed to find something else. And I needed to learn about other industries and other things.
Hey, just last week, and it was taken totally out of context, we spoke about with Adam Simpson about the private school comments.
Yeah.
But on the good side of it, you know, you obviously went to a great school and with a good family. That's the only thing at a footy club. The only thing everyone has in common is that they're good footballers.
Yeah.
But did it really impact you and say, well, this is actually a totally different world now, and you learn a lot more about different people and different cultures, I guess?
Yeah, you do, because, you know, everyone has their own upbringing, and it is it can be very vastly different, and that is the great thing about that team sport environment in the AFL, is you get to you know, learn and educate yourself about other people, other cultures, and it helps you so much develop as a person. And that's what I found, is people that I hadn't had a lot of interaction with or lifestyles with before I came to footy, I was able to, you know, get and build a relationship with those kinds of people. And I think that it helps you have more empathy for other people, and it helps you get along with people, which is actually really important in life, is you got to be able to cope and understand why someone's got to a situation that they are, why they're making the decision that they are. And if you just stay in your circle, then you're going to really struggle to be able to understand, you know, the thought process of other people. And I think that is the beauty of sport. It doesn't discriminate, and it should never discriminate on, you know, where you were born, what your parents did, anything like that. It's a beautiful level playing field.
And that's also a bit of Sheed's DNA, wasn't it? To make Essendon a nationwide club and also embrace the Aboriginal cultures and so forth like that. Did you get some real good insights and trips away and stuff like that along those lines?
Yeah, we were really like the work that Sheed's and the footy club had did in sort of the 80s and 90s and things like that. Like anywhere we went as a club, we just had enormous support, whether we were up in the Northern Territory or in Western Australia or South Australia. And that was built off the back of, I think, his foresight into, you know, we need to sell AFL to the rest of the country. And we've got such wonderful you know, cultures that we that can add so much value to this game, and this game can showcase these cultures as well, and that's what football does. I mean, you go and watch, and we use the Indigenous players out there, like they are the stars of this game, and they do it. You know, they are able to then. I think it's a great avenue for them to then talk about Aboriginal culture and to help educate people on, you know, the Indigenous society through what their exploits have been on the football field.
Because really, in the 80s, obviously, when your dad was a star, but Longy was almost the outlier, and now it's the norm for Aboriginal Indigenous stars all over the comp.
Yeah, that's right, and I think it's that they add so much to the game as well. Like it just they offer such different dimension to what you know, like other players can do.
So growing up, because we mentioned Sheeds, we should open the door there. Your perspective as a young kid and perspective as a player.
Yeah, well, I mean, Sheeds was I had a hard relationship with him, and I often think back though and think that you know, when you're 18, 19, you know, you're ignorant and you can be pig-headed, and Sheeds gave me some really good education on what I needed, and I just wasn't ready to receive it as often teenagers are, you know. And so I think back to some of the things that he was saying, and he was right, but I just I wasn't ready to sort of hear it. And so I have a good relationship with him now, but at the time I was like, oh god, what are you talking about? These rhymes and riddles. I don't understand. Give me a straight answer.
Was there similar with Mick?
Yeah, Mick was pretty hard. I remember he used to yell at me and abuse me and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, you get your back up and like, fuck, well, give us a spell. Like Job said, like, I thought I knew best. And I was playing in reserves, running around, not getting a kick. And I was like, I know more than this AFL legend. But one day he was going off at me. I was playing in the ones, I think, and we're in a meeting. He's like, mate, you know, I don't know, Swanee, I don't know why anyone wants to play with you. Like, you're killing your teammates, showed vision of me or whatever it was. And I walked out, I was like, you can get fucked, like. And then, like, Jono said to me, he goes, mate, if he's yelling at you, he means he cares, because see the blokes he's not yelling at, they'll be gone at the end of the year. So, like, if he's hard on you, he knows that you can be something. So that sort of turned my thinking around. I was like, well, he actually cares or understands that he can get something out of me by giving it to me, because other blokes, like, I'd be like, fucking look at this bloke. Like, he's horrible. Oh, he's doing something wrong. So he's fucking hopeless.
Yeah.
But he's not getting yelled at. He's getting patted on the back. But at the end of the year, he was gone. And somehow I managed to fucking stay. But, yeah, he was super hard on me. But, you know, like exactly what Job said, I didn't think I needed it. But he obviously was right. And he was one, must have been the only one who'd seen anything in me down in the reserves that I was going to be any good. So he obviously saw something in me which no one else did, not even myself. So, the player I was, whether you thought I was good or bad, to Mick, as he moulded me, the player I was, put me down back, put me up forward, and then let me go in the midfield.
Does that give you some memories similarly?
Yeah, I think it's like what a great coach does, isn't it? They see something in a player and then they help nurture it, and they understand what the trigger point is going to be to get them, and they never... You know, like they can be hard on you, but they never you never lose the player. You know, like you sort of, it's like a father almost. They give you these whacks, but then you always want to do something. You want to make them proud, or you want to perform for them, because you know that deep down they're invested in you and they care. And I think that's what those great coaches were. They're able to find something inside the players to make them want to perform for them.
Yeah, and they obviously, the legendary coaches had a way of, all right, this bloke needs a carrot, this bloke needs a stick. So it's like, some blokes, oh, fuck you, I'll show you that I can go out and do this. And like, some blokes didn't react that way. Some blokes would go into their shells when they got yada. So, all right, he needs to be given the carrot. Be like, Todd, you're going, okay, I'll Mick obviously thought I needed the stick, so I copped the stick quite a few times. But yeah, that's the way you react, right? Well, fuck yeah, I reckon I can do that.
Yeah,
I'll fucking show you. And yeah, then you'd go, you know, you'd sort of walk off the ground at the end of the game. Well, I can stick that up your ass, Mick. Like, yeah, well, I did that. And then, you know, only after you've finished or once you've become a regular senior player, you're like, oh, well, that's actually what he was trying to do the whole time instead of, you know, well, they obviously had a method behind their madness, which, like Job said, as young kids, you have no idea about. You just think he's yelling at you just because he's an arsehole.
Yeah.
But in the end, they have their reasons.
And that's a difficult thing, I think, about the AFL system is you're so young when you enter it.
Yeah.
And the knowledge that you gain, like by the time you're 24, you think, oh, God, I sort of wasted, you know, those first 6 years because I just didn't know. And you're not supposed to know when you're that young. And that's I think, where it's a bit different in the NFL, where you come into the system and you're 23, 24, and you've had to build these levels of work ethic to get there in the first place and get through college and all that sort of stuff. So you go there and you sort of hit the ground running, where in the AFL, you're just like these naive little kids and nor should you really know anything. You're 18 years old, you just got out of school.
Yeah.
Like, what are you supposed to do? This is professional of the world. It's a difficult sort of thing to walk into.
Do you think the age limit should be lifted?
I reckon it should be. Yeah, yeah. I think I think it for twofold. One, that it you know, physically and mentally, I think it would really help guys adjust. And the two, I think that year or two where you finished school and went into the system, I think it would get you a great perspective on other aspects of life, and the appreciation of going into the football environment, I think, would be higher. Guys who didn't have long careers had already started something or learned or worked out, okay, I like this, I don't like this. Because I think a lot of guys get to the end of their careers and they just don't know what they like or what they don't like. Yeah. And not everyone has the opportunity to take 2 or 3 years to work that out. You know, like, I think you finish your career and you got a mortgage, you got to do something, you've got to get a job, but I didn't really think about it, I don't know this, I don't know that. And so you get forced into something that you don't really want to do, and then you get unhappy about that, which is very natural. So I think that there's merit in that sort of self-discovery of that period when you're 18 to 20.
Because the average bloke in the or lady, it's common to have a gap year, travel the world and all that. You don't get that luxury if you're a professional sportsman.
No. That's one of the things you don't have. But and I think you don't have. I never really asked myself the question of what is it that I like, what is it that I want to do. You know, I didn't ask myself that question enough when I was playing. I got, you know, you caught up with next week, or I've got to do this, I've got to do that, so I've got to do this. But I think that that's sort of the question to help formulate the next path of your life is who am I, what do I like to do, what could make me happy, what am I interested in? And that will, I think, it helps to bridge that leaving the game and feeling lost, which I think a lot of people go through in any elite sport.
Anzac Day, talk us through the highlights, and obviously you would have shared the centre square with Swanee plenty of times.
Yeah, we used to line up on each other a lot of the time. Yeah.
Just at stoppages.
Yeah. We'd go back.
So Dane's got
to... Yeah, exactly.
Sorry to interrupt, but Dane's got to say, you can't win Brownlows having good defensive pressure.
that's the thing. I used to sort of always say to the guys, listen, do you want the ball in your hands or do you want it in mine?
Exactly.
You guys make the decision. But Anzac Day is—it's a really special. It's a special, special game. It's the one game that I miss the most of playing, yeah. And it's just the build-up to it, the silence before the game starts, and then just the roar. Like, I just never hear such passion in a crowd than when it was either Collingwood or Essendon. Like, it just felt like what it must have felt like to be, you know, like in the Colosseum in Rome, like that, you know, and that just this amphitheatre of. Emotion and energy, like, it was just extraordinary.
It is. It's Sheeds again, just
genius
created it. It's an incredible day, and I've always said every time I speak about it, it's like, even if you don't barry for Collingwood or Essendon, you have to go at least one day and stay till the first 5 minutes. You know, see the last post and the anthem and the ceremony before the game, and then the roar at the start, then the first 5 minutes. And then if you don't like both sides, you can leave. But it's an incredible, day. The games always sort of produce sort of decent-ish game soon, no matter where the two sides are on the ladder. But another one of Sheeds' awesome inventions. And so you played at Dreamtime, the G as well, did you do that?
Yeah, that was another one. You know, like just something so simple as the colours of the Aboriginal flag, the colours of the two teams, you know, like that's how his mind worked. Okay, and he thought, okay, there is something in this that we can then take and create a game around, and which then created everything else that is part of it. And now it's such a significant day in Australia and in the sporting world, but in the community as well. And that foresight and that lateral thinking, I think, is what made him such a great ambassador for the game.
I was just thinking while we're talking about him, that Swanee earlier this year said about how would you like to be taking over from Ed as Mark Corder when you were giving support to Mark Corder. It's impossible. In hindsight, now that you've got the benefit of hindsight, that would have been a tough gig for Matthew Knight sometime.
Yeah, very tough gig. And I always thought that probably at the time the club was under-resourced, and so a first-time coach coming in to an under-resourced sort of football department was a recipe for disaster. And, you know, Knight has gone on and had a really successful assistant coach career at Geelong, and he had some great, thoughts on the game and how it should be played. But I think that he and anyone who was, you know, making those decisions at that time would have said, okay, well, I'm probably not ready, and this infrastructure around me is not ready to support someone coming into this role as a first-time coach.
And given your belief and love of American sports, if we're looking at how many guys who have gone amiss, I'm using horse racing, saying, but as a young coach, you actually do need that real long apprenticeship, don't you? I mean, it's what he had to play in Nathan early doors, and he kept on improving as a coach, but years later.
Yeah, that's right. It's just, it's natural to you don't know, you know, a hell of a lot more in year five or six or something than you do in year one or two. Yeah. And I think that the problem is that we're so used to having immediate satisfaction. You know, life has become about immediate satisfaction, and that's trickled into our expectations for the teams that we support. You know, we want immediate results. We want immediate things to change. So that pressure just becomes more and more amplified for people in those positions.
On the good side, I spent a year with Herdy a couple of years back doing a podcast. And
how's that going?
I think it's still in delay. I think I'm expecting a call back any minute. But it was great fun, and some of his thoughts on the game were unbelievable. What was the good side of his coaching like before things went to shit?
Yeah, Herdy's a great manager of people. You know, like as a captain, he was I had a great relationship. You know, I loved playing under him. He was sort of one of those guys, a bit like, you know, what Swanee was talking about with Mick. You're like, you really wanted to, you know, play well for him, or you wanted to impress him, that sort of thing. He had that aura about him, and he was able to cultivate that feeling. Like, he wasn't demonstrative about it. He nurtured it, you know, and I think it's a real skill from a management side of things. You've got someone who's got such a big presence, but never felt like it was, you know, overbearing, or that you couldn't connect with him. I thought he was really good at management side of things, and had some good thoughts on the game as well. But, you know, I think that's the biggest strength as any coach is you have to be able to manage people, because you've got all these different personalities. Mm-hmm. They have to be able to you have to find something that connects you to them. And that was what his skill was.
And what was your mindset as a captain once you became captain?
I was tried to do something sort of similar, where that relationship, I had to be able to connect with every person in the locker room in some form. You know, it had to be, whether I had nothing in common with them, I had to find something, a common ground, because I needed them to want to play with me and wanted to be part of the team. I needed them to give every... It couldn't just be about their own career. Like, it couldn't be about them just having their best own individual career. They had to feel like they were part of something. And that was based off a connection I felt was... As the captain, if you could make a connection with them in some form, then they would feel part of the collective. And that was the key to building a strong team.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You never captain though.
I was in the leadership squad, the leadership team. No, it wasn't for me. You did too much extra work. Like
unpaid.
Exactly. I think I was vice captain for a couple of years, but in the end I went into Mick and said, listen, you might as well give it to someone else because it didn't change me.
Yeah.
So like I think when people get voted in the leadership group, it changes some people for the better, obviously. Like some people go, right, I'm a captain, I need to stand up, I need to lead, I need to be more vocal at training, I need to lead by example, I need to do this, where I didn't change. Like I was, whether it was for better or for worse, but I was the same person. So I was like, well, you might as well give it to someone else who actually might benefit from it because I'm the same person I was yesterday that I am today in the leadership group. So you might as well give it to someone else. So it didn't, not that the leadership didn't sit well with me. I thought I sort of led on field by example and stuff and the way I played, but it didn't change me in my off-field stuff and I wasn't super vocal at training and stuff like that. So I was like, you might as well give it to someone else who actually wants to roll. And I guess the other thing was like, it's hard to punish people when you're probably right there next to them.
Yeah.
Like, on the weekends, you know. Like, you know, and I guess I was probably the leak in the leadership team, you know what I mean? Like, we'd have a meeting and, like, say, when Steele and Blairy were out and we were going to get punished and I was there with them. But I didn't get caught, so I was like, well, fuck. And it's hard to sit there and go, well, you fucked up, Steele. Yeah, it's like, you fucked up, mate, Blairy. Shouldn't have been out drinking. Like, and I'm, like, sitting there going, oh, fuck, I was there. So that was sort of when, well, you know what? You go out and say, boys, you know, like, they know you were there.
Yeah.
So, like, don't deny it. Or sometimes I'd be like, well, we don't know you were there. So, like, you can get away with it. You know what I mean? So, I probably didn't help the fucking side, like, go together. But we were very successful. Well, we weren't very successful. We weren't successful. We won one flag. But, yeah, it probably wasn't for me because I was, and I didn't like to see anyone punished for anything. Like, I was more, like, well, as long as you play well and train well. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all I care about. But, yeah, so that's probably why my leadership skills were lacking because I'd be like, boys, they know, we know, well, we don't know anything. So even though I know you were there, they don't. So just deny it and they can't prove it so you won't get in trouble. Or
that's leadership right there.
Yeah, well, different kind. Or, you know, or listen, we know, they all know you were there. So, yeah, just come in and admit it, say you were doing this and you're going to cop a fucking week suspension or you're going to cop going to the beach at 6 a.m. or whatever, you know, whatever the punishment was. So, yeah, leadership really wasn't for me. I think I'd be good at welfare, though. Like, I think I would because I've done and experienced as many as most. So, I think I would be.
There's a potential earner in that, I would think.
Well, nothing's for nothing, bro. absolutely. But I think I could be a good ear to talk to, but yeah. That's it.
Because it's a fine line, isn't it? If someone has mucked up at a young age, do you want I was going to say Matthew Lloyd, do you want the up and down straight citizen or do you want someone who actually knows what it's like to fuck up?
You need a bit of both. You can't, because someone who's never done anything wrong and hasn't made any mistakes, they can't understand how people put themselves in that situation. They can't empathise and so all their decision making is based off only the things that they would do.
Yep.
So you need, that's why a group is helpful, you know, like where you, because you've got different types of personalities. We used to, one of the players, we had a group of guys who mucked up, and they had to go and see Bomber. And Bomber was a really intimidating bloke, like a scary sort of guy. And Bomber put them all in different rooms and would just go from each room and get a story and say, this bloke said this about you, what's happened? And so they all crumbled, and they lasted about 5 minutes before they just coughed up what had happened. But he was the old police sort of interrogating, separated, divide and conquer.
Jono and Tazza got an old punch on at when Mick said no one was allowed out, and they obviously went out. Tazza got an old punch on, Jono came out and helped him. And Mick's, and they had to go in the next morning, and Maxi Kleiman, the footy manager, said, you are not allowed to talk to Mick, look at him for 1 week. Like, and like when he meant, like, he absolutely, they were not allowed to make eye contact with Mick for 1 week. Like, that was their punishment. Like, they got suspended for a week and they weren't allowed to, not allowed to make eye contact with him for 1 week. And then that was the end of the year. They called in, he called Tazza a cunt and traded him at the end of the year. And then he's called Jono a fuckhead and just a fuck up. And then obviously Jono stayed. But yeah, so that was his punishment. You were not allowed to look at him for 1 week. That's how angry he was. So that was their punishment.
Who was the Bombers?
Yeah,
Rat Pack.
We had a few different times. This is a funny story. There was a fight one night between Essendon and Collingwood, I think. It's billboards. And I reckon it might have been, I can't remember who was involved, but might have been Mark Johnson from Essendon. And
I think it was Tazza.
They got in a punch on it, billboards. So we're sitting in, like an auditorium on the Monday morning, and everyone knew about it. So Sheeds gets up and he says, right, every person that was at billboards on Saturday night, get up and sit over this side of the room. So 80% of the group stood up, moved over to the other side of the room. And then poor old Teddy Richards, who's a good mate of mine, he sort of said, look, I was there, but I was there for 10 minutes. He goes, get over there, Richards. So we had all kinds of characters doing that.
And who was your main group of the Swanee equivalent of a Rat Pack?
Early on, sort of probably some funny guys.
Solly?
Solly McVeigh, Ramanaskis. They were sort of a bit of a Rat Pack, Mark Johnson. And then when I got older, I had to be careful with Tommy Bell Chambers, where he was, Sammy Lonigan, Tate Pears. Those sort of guys were Michael Hibbard was he was a constant, like, throughout my whole career, but he was always so funny, his story. So I sort of had a soft spot for him.
Geez, it changed though, because when did you get drafted?
02.
Yeah, so yeah. Yeah, I was 01. But like, I remember the boys, the Shaw brothers, the Cloaks, and a handful of others. Like, imagine doing this now. They got into a punch on a Wednesday night at the half on the piss and got pepper sprayed during the footy seat, during the footy seat. Like, could you imagine the boy, you'd all be sacked.
Yeah, they'd sack you on the spot, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but the problem was that they weren't out.
Yeah.
The problem was they got into a punch on and got police. So I was how funny, 10 years later, if a group of blokes got pinged at the pub on a Wednesday night.
That's enough to be sacked.
Yeah, 10 of years, but it wasn't the fact that, probably was a bit, they were out late, but being at a pub having a few beers on a Wednesday before a Saturday was sort of, it wasn't okay, but it wasn't a sackable offence.
Nah.
But it was the fact that they got pepper sprayed and got an old punch on. The punishment that we had was we all had to be in the whole team, obviously you get punished as one. You had to be in at 6 a.m, say the fucking next day or the day after. And they, which is probably topical now because of the boxing rule, it's not allowed.
Yeah.
We had, so we all the, so six of them that got, that were at the pub, they had two boxing gloves. They had obviously a set of boxing gloves on, and they had to fight two blokes with one glove on each. And mate, and they got absolutely hammered. Like, talk about concussions. I won't name names, but one of them started to cry and then got his old man down. His old man come down and complained. It was a shit show. But
just in saying that, I've got someone at about $1.40.
brothers, but. But
$1.20.
But my son of the pot, and because the boys were pretty pissed off, they're like, fuck yeah. You being here at 6 a.m, I'm gonna show you. And two blokes just hit them as hard as they can go. It was And I was thank fuck, I wasn't there Wednesday night. But, that's how much the world's changed. Like, yeah. And even some of the senior blokes were going to Frostbite on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
Playing at the MCG on a Saturday. Like, you did that now. One person takes a photo. That's your career's done.
Your career's done.
But
the punishment to the crime is outweighed now much more, isn't it? You know, like, you get sacked by Twitter before you arrive at the club.
Exactly.
That sort of happens. Yeah. So it's just that's how amplified everything has become.
Yeah, it's wild.
Actually, speaking of that, so Dane, you've been a bit active this week, and congratulations. You decided to do Dry July?
Yeah, I did, from the 31st. Yeah. It was tough. Well, if I had known we were going back into lockdown, I would have broken that, but I had a few last night. I had the Last Supper, 6.0.
Yep.
Well, Jesus, I only had one. But we've had six, but yeah, stayed Dry July for a night, which is nice. But
well done. We're proud of you.
Mate, you know what? I don't know what.
But you're a tad less active on Twitter. I think your last tweet was 18 months ago.
Yeah, very infrequent.
Do you scroll on it? Or?
Yeah, I look at it. Yeah. Because I love like the NFL and all sorts of stuff. So I like to look at it. I just don't really.
We don't have a TV. You fucking, what else do you do it on?
I'm reading books by candlelight.
Exactly, yeah.
Books.
With a quill.
Lost 8 again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just want to. I first met you when you were about 17 or 18 because SEN's first year.
Yep.
I was producer from about halfway through, and Tim changed my life in this way. So it was Gary, Billy, Tim, Rod Law, who was program manager, me. That could have been it. Just he had a barbecue at your place.
Yep.
No, pizza oven.
Might
have fired that up too. Yeah.
Yep.
So about 3 hours in, and where's Tim? He actually left his own backyard Bobby just to go upstairs because he had enough of people talking. Does that shock you?
That does not shock me one bit. Like it would shock you that someone who has lived a public life for his whole adult life since he's 15 years old would leave his own barbecue to go upstairs. Like, that is a very frequent occurrence. And there's a reason why he goes down to the farm as much as he can. And it is completely isolated, which is the way he likes it.
I think he bought the farm while I was working with him at the time. So it's Gippsland Way. And
down in Gippsland.
Do you use it a bit as well?
He's got the vines in there, so he's very particular about his grapes and things like that. He makes his own wine. And
how is it?
Yeah, it's very good, actually. It's very good.
What is it?
Dumb luck. It's a Fiano, which is a white. He's actually just started to stock it in a very select couple of places. Yeah, so he's quite proud of that.
What's it called? Give him
it's called Mary's Vineyard.
Mary's Vineyard.
Which is my mother's mum. That was her name.
Yeah.
Because the other one, and it's related to that. I mean, so when you're doing breakfast radio, you afterwards you go out for a coffee for an hour and talk.
How long do you do breakfast radio for?
He's done it. So he started SEM.
2004 was the first year.
Yeah, the first year.
18 years.
18 years. Yeah, he had a couple years off. And now he's back to...
I lasted 12 weeks.
Yeah. As a segment guy.
What was your shift?
Well, it varied from 7 till anywhere from 7 a.m. to 8:45 a.m. on a Monday morning.
Yeah.
Mondays aren't for me.
No, not the right... They chose the wrong day of the
week. No, that's what I said. Tuesday to Friday, I'm all good. Monday morning's a tough... Fuck. I don't know how your old man's done. I didn't last a footy season. And he's done 18 years. Incredible stuff. Incredible stuff.
So we'd usually chat for an hour, and the talk sheet actually time was important because, let's say most workplaces, it's about the next day, but as well as talking shit. And I remember Bill would average, Brownless would average 4 to 6 sportsman's nights a week, even though he was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I remember Tim saying, I don't often give out public, private conversation, but he was just in marvel because he said whenever someone twists his arm to do a public talk, which is rare.
Yeah.
He'd be anxious about it for 5 weeks leading into it. And he's going, look at Bill, just
fine. Just off the back,
loves it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's never, I don't know where, I mean, but he's an atypical introvert, you know, like that's his personality type.
And then a couple of years afterwards, at an Irvine club, which I'm part of, he was the speaker. He is as good as anyone. Yeah. And he's, because it starts with his stuff in Dimboola.
Yeah. 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 No.
How Western had recruited him.
I think it's probably got something to do with being a 15 year old getting exposed as a 15 year old. I think that's had a lasting influence on him.
All right, just a quick one to finish. We've done Anzac Day. Just whatever you want to say. Kevin Sheedy.
Yeah, well, he's an icon of the game, Sheets. Yeah. And although I had some bumps in the road with him, I have an appreciation for him after.
He loves a sportsman's night.
He's a good sportsman's night operator.
Yeah, yeah. Jeez, he brings some stuff too. Yeah. He backs the truck up with his jumpers and books and paintings. Oh, mate, absolutely. Yeah.
He's always got a Sharpie on hand.
Hasn't he? Yeah.
Herdy the player.
Yeah, I heard he was my idol, you know, as a kid. So he was an unbelievable player.
Is he the best you played with?
Yeah, he was the best player I played with. Yeah.
Herdy the coach?
Well, before everything that happened, Herdy was a great coach, and I think he was going along that track. And then, you know, he, like a lot of people who were heavily involved in it, you know, it was became debilitating to him.
Yeah. Yep. Matty Lloyd?
Lloyd is the funniest bloke I know that doesn't try to be funny.
You're laughing at him or with him?
Most of the time, it's a mixture of both. But he's a very, very funny guy, Lloyd. Yeah.
Fletch?
Fletch, very laid back, but had a great ability to connect with people 20 years his junior. Like, he's a very, very easygoing guy, good person to be around.
How did he play for so long? It's
I think it was his, like, personality type where nothing bothered him. He just got on with things.
How was he on the track?
It wasn't a huge track. It wasn't a big sort of track operator. He waited until the balls came out.
Yeah.
But, he was one of those guys that every person respected and loved who played with him. You know, like, every person who came in the club, because he just treated everyone the same. You know, he was just such a nice person.
And just to finish, we've had an hour of fun for people in lockdown who are doing it tough. When all of a sudden you can't do what you want to do, it ain't fun. So what were some of the coping mechanisms you went through when you had to stop?
Yeah, I remember when after I got banned, you know, I was obviously really flat and really struggling with it. And I went down to the farm, you know, by myself and I wrote a list of things that I wanted to do in that next 12 months and things that I hadn't done before and new experiences, but just almost like a bit of a goal setting for myself. And then I tried to tick that off, tried to take myself out of my comfort zone. But it was about, you know, understanding that difficult things happen to everyone and it's just what you do with them and then how you can respond out of them. And I think that this, you know, for a lot of people are really hurting out there. And it's very, very sad to see, you know, what's happened to a lot of people. And there's a lot of... there's care and people can reach out to things and make an effort to go and speak to someone if they need help.
Did you get many off your list?
I did. Ticked everything on my list.
Well done.
Yep.
Well, I will finish with one here. Cause, so you gave Joby's Brownlow.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. The night.
Because I'm looking at the cutaway and there's Dato comes out and puts the medal on and then let's all toast Joe Watson for winning the Brownlow. You're still there for the drink.
Well, exactly. It's my moment. Oh, was up. Bruce loved it. He's an air genius.
Yeah,
oh,
the best. Fantastic. If you had a TV, you'd be watching some of it.
I know, but I just have to take it in a second hand.
Still haven't got my head around that.
Good stuff, mate. Appreciate you doing it.
No problem. Thanks guys. Mate. Cheers.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.